Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we cut through the noise and get right to the good stuff. You know that feeling, right? You're scrolling or driving, or maybe watching a show and a song comes on that just absolutely gets you. It's poignant, it's powerful, hits you in that deep, resonant place. But maybe you don't really know the full story behind the band or the artist. Well, today we're diving headfirst into one of those stories. And trust me, it's a journey you're going to want to take. I'm talking about a band whose music has, well, quite likely, soundtracked significant emotional moments in your life without you even consciously realizing it. Picture this. A crucial turning point in a gripping TV series, maybe a breathtaking scene in a dramatic film, or perhaps even a commercial that sticks with you long after it's over. I am willing to bet with absolute certainty that you have heard The Funeral by Band of Horses.
Oh, absolutely. It's one of those, isn't it?
It is absolutely everywhere, right? An almost ubiquitous track that has become a true cultural touchstone.
Yeah.
It often serves as the quintessential gateway to understanding their distinctive sound, that incredible kind of intoxicating blend of soaring indie rock, grounded southern rock, and heartfelt folk rock.
Yeah, that mix is what really gives them their unique appeal and, well, their enduring quality, I think.
So today's mission, should you choose to immerse yourself in it, is a comprehensive deep dive into Band of Horses. They're the American rock band that first formed way back in 2004. But more specifically, we're really focusing on the undeniable singular driving force behind it all, singer-songwriter Ben Bridwell. We're going to meticulously trace their journey, you know, from those raw, early Seattle beginnings. We'll navigate through the often turbulent labyrinth of numerous lineup changes.
And there were many.
Oh, yeah. We'll celebrate their remarkable musical milestones, yes, including a coveted Grammy nomination, and truly understand how they've not just survived, but thrived, how they've maintained their enduring presence in the ever-evolving music scene right up to, well, pretty much today.
And that's precisely our goal for you today. Consider this your definitive shortcut to being genuinely thoroughly well-informed about Band of Horses. We've meticulously sifted through stacks of articles, you know, deep research papers, and our own extensive notes to extract only the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight. Our aim is to give you a truly comprehensive understanding of their unique journey, their creative challenges, their resounding triumphs, and their lasting impact on the landscape of modern rock. We want to connect those sometimes disparate dots, offering you those incredibly satisfying aha moments, you know?
Yeah, putting the pieces together.
Exactly, and ensure that you walk away from this deep dive feeling thoroughly informed with all the crucial context, but never, ever overwhelmed by just, like, tons of information.
Right.
So with that in mind, let's unpack this fascinating story. The origins. From Seattle to a Southern Sound, 2004-2006.
Okay, let's unpack this indeed. We're starting at the very beginning with the architect of it all, the man himself, Ben Bridwell. Born Benjamin Bridwell on April 25, 1978 in Irmo, South Carolina. But what's truly striking, looking at his early life, is this immediate sense of movement and, well, independence. By the age of 16, he'd already left home, making this significant move all the way to Tucson, Arizona, to live with his mother.
Wow, 16. That's young to make such a big move.
It really is. What do you think that early independence and relocation tells us about Ben Bridwell's inherent drive? It suggests a restless spirit, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. A kind of inner compass that always sought new horizons, perhaps. That early nomadic experience, moving from South Carolina to Arizona at such a formative age, it absolutely sets a precedent for his resilience and adaptability. These are traits that become incredibly significant later on.
Right. When we look at the band.
Exactly. When we observe the constant flux within Band of Horses, it speaks to a comfort with change, or maybe just a necessity to navigate it, which would become a defining characteristic of his entire career. This wasn't a kid afraid of striking out on his own, you know, and that fearlessness would permeate his artistic and entrepreneurial endeavors later.
And his early connections were so foundational too.
Yeah.
While he was in Tucson, and later when he moved to Seattle, he was working alongside people who would become key figures in his musical journey.
Mm-hmm.
People like Matt Brook and Jen Champion.
Mm-hmm.
They were even selling pizza together at one point. Yo. Can you imagine the future Grammy-nominated artist slinging pies?
Huh. It's a great image, isn't it?
It really is. And then later working in a bar together. It's interesting how those seemingly casual everyday interactions often become the fertile ground for major artistic partnerships. What's your take on that? How do those shared life experiences influence the trust and chemistry needed for a band?
Well, it's an insightful observation. What's fascinating here is how those seemingly small everyday interactions form the bedrock for significant artistic partnerships. These aren't just casual acquaintances. They're the people he's sharing life experiences with, whether it's the grind of selling pizzas or the late nights of bar work. That shared history, those common struggles, and the trust built in those non-musical environments. They're absolutely invaluable when you're embarking on a creative venture.
Yeah, something that demands deep collaboration and vulnerability.
Precisely. It creates a bond that goes beyond just shared musical taste. It's a deeper connection.
But Braidwell wasn't just working odd jobs. He also dipped his toes into the music industry pretty early on with an entrepreneurial venture. He founded Brown Records in Seattle.
Right, his own label.
Yeah, and his initial intention for it was incredibly humble, almost refreshingly so. He saw it as just a stepping stone, his words, a way to press like 1,000 CDs, get them into local stores and maybe onto local radio and give bands material for shows, all with the hope that maybe a real label would pick it up.
So not aiming for world domination from the start.
Not at all.
Yeah.
So Brown Records was a kind of crucible for him, wasn't it? An early taste of the immense pressure that comes with not just artistic ambition, but also, you know, entrepreneurial responsibility.
Absolutely. And this is a key insight into Bridwell's character that we see resurface later. He himself later reflected that Brown Records got a lot busier than I ever imagined and basically went out of control. He said he ended up cracking under the pressure and temporarily abandoning the label.
Wow.
Yeah. So this early experience provides such rich insight into his aspirations, initially quite altruistic, you know, wanting to help unheard artists, but also the unforeseen, overwhelming challenges of running a business, especially where, as he put it, people's livelihoods were resting in my hands.
That's heavy.
It is. It shows an early, maybe even naive ambition that was quickly tempered by the harsh realities of the industry. This struggle to balance creative support with business demands, it definitely shaped his understanding of artistic control and responsibility for years to come.
Speaking of connections and musical apprenticeship, his journey really took a significant step forward when he joined Carissa's Weird.
Ah, yes. A legendary Seattle band in its own right.
Totally. He initially replaced their drummer, Robin Perringer, who had left for Modest Mouse.
Another big name connection there.
Right. And then Bridwell later transitioned to bass guitar. So this wasn't just a brief stint. It shows his adaptability and a genuine willingness to learn different instruments and roles within a band structure.
His time with Carissa's Weird is truly a foundational chapter. It illustrates his deep commitment to music itself, rather than being fixated on just one specific instrument or role. He wasn't just a drummer, then just a bassist. He was absorbing the dynamics of band life, the craft of songwriting from different perspectives, and the art of collaboration.
Learning the ropes.
Exactly. This learning curve and adaptability are crucial for understanding how he later navigated the constant lineup changes in Band of Horses. And it's a fascinating full circle moment, isn't it? That Robin Perringer, the drummer he replaced, would actually rejoin Bridwell's band years later.
Yeah, we'll get to that. So Carissa's Weird eventually split in 2003, which became a pivotal moment for Bridwell. And it was Matt Brook, his old friend and collaborator.
From the pizza and bar days?
Exactly. He stepped in and helped Bridwell learn guitar and actually begin songwriting.
So this is the shift.
This feels like the crucial moment, doesn't it? Where Ben Bridwell truly steps into his own as a frontman, finding his distinct voice and starting to write his own material.
Absolutely. It's the crucible moment. But what's remarkable is that Brook, his longtime collaborator, apparently recognized it immediately. He saw Bridwell's raw talent wasn't just blossoming, it was demanding to lead. Brook himself later expressed immense pride, saying he felt maybe Carissa's Weird was holding him back all this time.
Wow, that's quite a statement.
It is. And he said Bridwell took the ball and ran with it. It speaks volumes about their shared history and mutual respect that this transition was so seamless, yet so profound. This is truly the origin story of Band of Horses, with Bridwell stepping forward into the spotlight.
And then came the band's initial formation in 2004. At first, they were just called Horses. The lineup was Chris Early on bass and Tim Meinig on drums.
Simple enough name.
You'd think.
Yeah.
But as often happens in the Wild West of band names, they quickly ran into a snag. They had to change it to Band of Horses after discovering a long-defunct band featuring none other than, wait for it, actor Don Johnson.
Get out! That Don Johnson? Miami Vice?
The very same. Apparently, his old band was re-releasing material, so yeah, Band of Horses it became.
That's hilarious. But also, yeah, a very practical necessity in carving out their unique identity in a crowded musical landscape.
Right. You don't want that confusion.
Yeah.
It's a great example of the unexpected practical hurdles that can shape artistic endeavors, even something as seemingly simple as a band name.
Imagine trying to explain to fans that this Horses is not that Horses. The extra two words made all the difference in defining who they were.
So, with the name settled, we get to their debut album, Everything All the Time, which came out in 2006. How did they first catch the attention of the industry? Because they got picked up by Sub Pop pretty quickly, didn't they?
They did. They gained early crucial attention by opening for Iron and Wine in Seattle. This proved to be a pivotal opportunity as it led directly to interest from Sub Pop Records.
And Sub Pop, for anyone who doesn't know, is legendary.
Absolutely. A kingmaker in the Pacific Northwest indie scene, known for its keen ear for talent. Nirvana, Soundgarden, The Shins, the list goes on. Their endorsement was a massive signal of quality, and actually, as a precursor to the album, they released a tour EP in 2005. They sold it at shows and on Sub Pop's website.
How smart.
Yeah, it acted as a perfect testing ground for their sound and helped build that early crucial buzz before the full album dropped.
They recorded Everything All the Time in 2005 with producer Phil Eek, another Seattle indie stalwart.
Mm-hmm. Known for his work with Built to Spill, Fleet Foxes. A great choice for them.
Yeah. And Bridwell had quite an ambitious vision for it initially, didn't he? I read he wanted an ELO-sounding record, like Electric Light Orchestra, with strings and keyboards and synths.
Wow, that's not quite what we got on the final album, is it?
Not really. It sounds quite different.
It does, and this reveals an early artistic tension and compromise that would kind of recur throughout their career. Bridwell had this grand, almost orchestral vision, but ultimately they opted for a more raw approach, as he put it.
Which probably worked out better for a debut, maybe.
Quite possibly. That decision likely shaped the band's early identity significantly, leaning into a more organic, immediate, and intimate sound that resonated powerfully with audiences. It's a fascinating insight into the push and pull of a visionary's grand ideas versus the practical, often more raw execution that sometimes defines a band's initial success.
The album featured that original four-piece lineup, Bridwell, Meinig, Early, and Brooke.
Yeah.
But interestingly, Sarah Cahoon also received drumming credits.
Yeah, suggesting some collaboration beyond the core, maybe some shared studio time or different takes.
The album was released on March 21st, 2006. It actually saw some minor chart success early on in Scandinavia, particularly in Sweden and Norway.
Interesting, hinting at that early international appeal.
Exactly. But the real game changer, the first single that truly catapulted them, was, of course, The Funeral.
Indeed. The significance of The Funeral just cannot be overstated. It became their breakthrough track. It was widely adopted in, well, everything. Numerous television series, films, video games, and advertisements.
It really was everywhere. Still is, sometimes.
It essentially became a poignant cultural touchstone. Its melancholic beauty, Bridwell's really distinctive vocal delivery, and that swelling, almost anthemic quality. It made it incredibly versatile for emotional moments across various media.
Hmm.
And performing it on The Late Show with David Letterman further cemented its status and introduced the band to a much broader American audience.
Even though, ironically, Matt Brooke had already left the band by the time they played Letterman.
Right. Which brings us to
the early lineup volatility.
Exactly.
Tim Meinig and Chris Early, two of the original members on that first album, departed soon after the album's recording. Bridwell explained it pretty bluntly as a personality clash. He said, "All of a sudden I was with two guys I didn't really even know. They were nice guys. There just wasn't a personality match."
What's fascinating here is how early this pattern of lineup changes begins. It starts almost immediately. It establishes Ben Bridwell as the undisputed core of the band from the get-go, and it highlights his specific need for a certain kind of chemistry within the group.
It wasn't just about playing the notes right.
Exactly. This isn't just about musical skill, but about the interpersonal dynamics that make a band function, especially under the intense pressure of growing success and constant touring. For Bridwell, the match had to extend beyond just talent.
And then Matt Brook, who was such a key figure, you know, from the Chris's Weird Days and instrumental in Band of Horses formation, he also left before that Letterman performance. What was his perspective? Why step away from what was clearly becoming a breakout success, especially given their deep history?
Brook's explanation offers valuable insight into that dynamic of creative control and personal ambition we talked about. He stated that he'd never really given the commitment to be a formal member, viewing it more as a spur-of-the-moment arrangement. He genuinely felt it was 100% Ben's project.
Wow.
Yeah. And he desired to see what else I could do, which led him to form his own band, Grand Archives, who also signed to Sub Pop, interestingly enough.
So no bad blood, necessarily. It's different paths.
Seems like it. This clearly illustrates that even close collaborators recognized Bridwell's singular vision and leadership from the outset. Brook respected that vision, but wanted to forge his own path rather than simply contributing to someone else's.
So, with Meinig, Early, and Brook out, new touring members were quickly brought in to fill the gaps for the shows. Joe Arnone came in on guitar and keyboards, Rob Hampton on bass and guitar, and Creighton Barrett took over on drums.
A quick regrouping to keep the momentum going after the album's release and the funeral taking off.
Exactly. And then, a pivotal personal decision for Bridwell, which really impacted the band's identity. He decided to relocate the entire operation from Seattle. Where did he go?
Back home, yes. Bridwell made the significant decision to move the band from Seattle, where it all started, back to his native South Carolina before they even recorded their second album.
Why the move?
His reasoning was deeply personal and very compelling. He said, "We were touring so much that nowhere was really home, so I figured if I'm going to come home after these long stretches of traveling, it would be nice to be around my family."
That makes a lot of sense, actually.
It does. This move wasn't just geographical. It was about personal grounding, reconnecting with his roots, and finding a stable anchor amidst the chaos of touring life. And this undoubtedly influenced the band's evolving identity and sound, subtly infusing that Southern rock and folk rock sensibility more deeply into their aesthetic. It really solidified that Band of Horses could be wherever Ben Bridwell called home. 2, finding their footing. Critical acclaim and evolving lineups, 2007-2009.
That personal connection, that grounding, certainly makes sense when you listen to the band's aesthetic evolve. Moving into 2007, before the release of their second album, the band kept up an incredibly active touring schedule. They were all over Europe and North America.
Keeping the buzz alive.
Yeah. And with that touring came, surprise, surprise, more lineup adjustments. Joe Arnone was out, and they actually expanded to a 6-piece for the tour. Matt Gentling from Archers of Loaf came in on bass.
Another great indie connection there.
Definitely. And Robin Perringer, yes. That Robin Perringer from Modest Mouse and Carissa's Weird Return on Guitar.
The full circle moment.
Right. And Ryman Rowe joined on keyboards.
What's truly striking here is that continuous search for the right musical synergy, even as they were gaining traction and building a solid fan base. The return of Robin Perringer is a fantastic detail, highlighting the tight-knit community of musicians Bridwell operated within and his willingness to bring back trusted collaborators. And the inclusion of Ryan Monroe on keyboards also proves to be incredibly significant. He becomes a long-term fixture in the band, contributing to a more expansive, textured sound that would really define their next phase.
So this period shows Bridwell still experimenting, right? Constantly refining the live and studio configuration to achieve the sound he was hearing in his head.
Exactly. Always searching for that perfect synergy.
Their second album, Cease to Begin, was released in October 2007. It was recorded in Asheville, North Carolina, fitting with the move south, and once again produced by Phil Eake.
Ah, so some important continuity there with Eake behind the board again.
Yeah. The core recording trio for this album featured Ben Bridwell, Creighton Barrett on drums, and Rob Hampton on bass guitar, with Ryan Monroe specifically credited with playing keyboards.
This suggests maybe a tightening of the creative unit for the studio work, perhaps a core group where ideas were most effectively translated into a cohesive sound on the record?
Could be. And Cease to Begin proved to be a major breakthrough in the U.S. It wasn't just building on the buzz of the funeral, it solidified their artistry. It reached number 35 on the Billboard 200, which was a significant achievement for an indie rock act back then.
Huge jump.
It also continued their international success, charting well again in Norway, Denmark, France, and Sweden. So their global appeal was definitely growing beyond just that one big single.
And the critics liked it too, right?
They did. The critical acclaim followed suit. Pace magazine voted it the 9th best album of 2007, and Rolling Stone placed it at 47th.
Respectable rankings.
Yeah, this wasn't just a sophomore slump. It firmly established them as a critically respected and commercially viable force.
The album itself, while still having that raw edge, introduced maybe a greater warmth and expansiveness. You can really hear Monroe's keys filling things out.
Definitely felt like a step forward, maybe more mature. And the song, No One's Gonna Love You, became their first European hit single, reaching number 22 in Denmark. That helped expand their reach beyond the massive shadow of The Funeral.
Give them another calling card internationally.
Exactly. And with this success, the lineup started to solidify even more, didn't it? Which, given their history up to that point, is quite a feat.
It absolutely did. Following the album's release and its burgeoning success, Ryan Monroe officially became a permanent member. They also recruited the talented Tyler Ramsey on guitar and vocals, and Bill Reynolds came in on bass. This brought Band of Horses back to a robust six-piece lineup.
Okay, so who was in this seemingly stable lineup then?
All right, so you had Bridwell, Creighton Barrett on drums, Ryan Monroe on keys, Tyler Ramsey on guitar vocals, Bill Reynolds on bass, and Rob Hampton was still involved on guitar bass around this time too, though he'd depart later. This particular configuration would prove to be the most stable for a significant period, marking a really crucial step in their evolution.
A bit of breathing room, maybe?
Perhaps. And notably, Tyler Ramsey often performed solo as the opening act before the band played live.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, showcasing the individual talent within the group and offering audiences an extra layer to the experience. It was an early glimpse into the wider creative energy simmering within the band.
This newfound stability clearly paid off on the live circuit. In 2008, Band of Horses made appearances at some of the most prestigious festivals globally. We're talking Glastonbury in the UK.
Ah, sick.
Tees in the Park in Scotland. The legendary Bridge School benefit concert organized by Neil Young in California, and the Roskilde Festival in Denmark.
That's a huge step up, isn't it? These aren't just club gigs. These are major international stages.
Yeah.
Totally. It showcased their growing renown and their ability to command much larger audiences.
Indeed. These high-profile festival appearances are a clear indicator of their accelerating ascent. It demonstrated that their music resonated on a grand scale, allowing them to connect with massive, diverse crowds. Playing these iconic stages not only bolstered their reputation, but also exposed their unique blend of indie and southern rock to an even broader international audience.
Right, solidifying their status as a major touring act capable of captivating thousands.
Exactly. It's a testament to the power of that stable lineup finally finding its stride and delivering consistently impactful live performances. 3, the Grammy nomination era. Infinite Arms and Expanding Horizons, 2010-2011.
Okay, now we move into what many consider their commercial and critical zenith, leading up to the album Infinite Arms in 2010. Producer Phil Eek announced back in May 2009 that he was recording their third album, again in North Carolina.
Back with Eek again. Seems like a winning formula for them.
It did seem to be. Interestingly, Ben Bridwell actually mentioned an initial title, Night Rainbows, during their 2009 summer tour.
Night Rainbows, okay.
Before the eventual reveal of the title Infinite Arms in March 2010, it gives us a little glimpse into the creative process, doesn't it? How album titles and perhaps even the whole direction can evolve.
It truly does. Those initial title mentions and then the eventual change, they hint at the creative fluidity and potential shifts in direction that happen behind the scenes. It's a reminder that even established artists are constantly refining their vision, allowing ideas to gestate and transform. This period, however, also saw continued lineup challenges, reinforcing that ongoing theme of Bridwell as the constant.
Who left this time?
Rob Hampton departed prior to recording. And there was a Swedish guitarist, Ludvig Bose, who joined briefly but then left by March 2010, so he ultimately didn't appear on the album.
Wow, still churning even as they were hitting their stride.
It underscores how persistent the challenge of maintaining a perfectly consistent lineup remained for Band of Horses, even as their star was truly beginning to rise.
Despite those shifts and the ongoing churn, Infinite Arms was recorded by what seemed like a more stable five-piece lineup: Bridwell, Ramsey, Reynolds, Barrett, and Monroe.
Right, that core group really seemed to gel for this record.
This sounds like a period of more settled collaboration, at least in the studio, which often translates into a more cohesive album, wouldn't you say?
It certainly seemed that way. That stable five-piece configuration allowed for a greater degree of artistic cohesion, a shared vision that really shines through on the album. Infinite Arms saw a massive worldwide release between May 14 and 19, 2010. And it wasn't just through major labels like Columbia and Fat Possum.
Hang on, didn't Bridwell's own label get involved here too?
Yes. Significantly, it was also released through Bridwell's own Brown Records.
Through Return of Brown Records.
Exactly. This marked the successful relaunch of his label on a much larger scale. It indicated a renewed commitment to that entrepreneurial spirit and maybe a desire for greater artistic and business control, applying the lessons learned from his earlier experiences.
That's really interesting. Where did they record it?
The recording locations were Echo Mountain Studios in North Carolina and Perfect Sound Studios in Los Angeles, so a blend of regional intimacy and maybe some LA industry polish. And crucially, the album was self-produced by the band, with additional production from Philaek.
Ah, so taking more control in the studio, too.
Definitely. It indicated a mature confidence in their own sound and direction.
Now, the band really went all out on promotion for this record.
Yeah.
In April 2010, they performed a full set for the WDR-TV show Rock Palace in Germany.
A big deal in Europe.
Yeah. And they made a high-profile appearance on the BBC television series later, with Jules Holland in the UK. They promoted Infinite Arms, with new songs like Compliments, Factory, and NW Apt. What was the immediate impact of those kinds of high-visibility appearances?
The Jules Holland appearance, in particular, had an immediate and palpable effect. It really demonstrated the power of traditional media, even then. Get this. Their two earlier albums, Everything All the Time and Cease to Begin, actually entered the UK albums chart for the first time after that performance.
Wow, years after they were released.
Exactly. Incredible for back catalog albums. More importantly, Infinite Arms itself debuted at number 21 in the UK, which was their first top 100 hit there, and it absolutely surpassed Cease to Begin in the US by debuting at an impressive number 7 on the Billboard 200.
Number 7, that's huge.
This was undoubtedly their commercial zenith, a moment where critical acclaim and mainstream success really converged. And to top it off, an outtake from the album, a song called Life on Earth, was even used on the soundtrack of the Twilight Saga film Eclipse.
Oh yeah, the Twilight soundtracks were massive.
Huge. Released in June 2010, it further broadened their audience to a massive global demographic that might not typically seek out indie rock.
That's incredible, hitting a commercial peak and getting that kind of widespread recognition across all these different platforms. And they didn't just stop there. They truly expanded their horizons that year with extensive global touring to support the album.
Their 2010 tour was absolutely massive. It spanned Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan. They weren't just headlining smaller venues anymore. They were also opening for major acts like Pearl Jam on their Midwest and East Coast tours.
Wow, opening for Pearl Jam.
Right. And for Snow Patrol in Bangor and Glasgow, this exposed their music to even larger audiences. Plus, they played at numerous high-profile festivals. SXSW, Sasquatch, Splendor in the Grass in Australia, Summer Sonic in Japan, Puckle Pop in Belgium, Reading and Leeds in the UK, ACL Fest, Farm Aid.
Just hitting all the big ones.
Yeah, pretty much. This incredible global reach and presence at such diverse iconic festivals really cemented their status as a significant international act. It showed they could appeal to a wide array of music lovers from different backgrounds and preferences. The album itself, Infinite Arms, was widely seen as their most ambitious and polished work to date.
How would you describe its sound compared to the earlier stuff?
Maybe blending their signature sound with a newfound sense of grandeur. It's often cited for its lush arrangements and powerful anthemic qualities. Still them, but bigger, maybe.
And amongst all that intense touring and promotion, they even managed to release a unique cover. On October 7, 2010, Band of Horses released their version of CeeLo Green's Georgia.
Ah, yeah, I remember this. It was CeeLo's version of their own song, No One's Gonna Love You, wasn't it? Bit meta.
Exactly. And Bridwell had a deeply personal and nostalgic explanation for covering CeeLo's take on his song. He connected it to his family's roots in Georgia, the Georgia Bulldogs football team, and how the state had always been a second home of sorts with many family members there.
That makes sense.
He even mentioned their annual New Year's Eve shows in Atlanta. It was released as a 7-inch vinyl split single.
Which is a cool old school format. This anecdote beautifully illustrates how deeply personal experiences can directly inspire artistic output, even in a roundabout way like this. It's a fantastic example of an artist connecting their art to their own life, family history, and even specific cultural touchstones like football.
Yeah, it adds a crucial humanizing layer to the band's work.
And shows Bridwell's willingness to share that personal side, deepening the listener's connection to his creative motivations.
They also pushed creative boundaries with their music videos around this time. On November 16, 2010, they premiered the video for Dilly. Now, while previous videos were often collections of still photographs, Dilly was different. It was a full-on narrative video.
Right, a proper music video.
Shot in the Mojave Desert by Phil Endelman. And here's the kicker. It was exclusively premiered on IMDb.
IMDb, the movie database.
Yep. Apparently, it marked the first time the website had ever premiered a music video.
Wow, that's unexpected. A smart promotional move, though.
Totally. And the content itself was pretty surreal and memorable. It featured a troublemaking motorcycle gang with sequences of them dancing in formation and even killing people by shooting them with nothing more than a pointed finger.
Okay, definitely memorable. What's fascinating here is the band's innovative approach not just to music, but to visual storytelling and promotion. Partnering with IMDb for an exclusive premiere was a clever, forward-thinking move. It showed their awareness of evolving media platforms and how to reach audiences in new, unexpected ways. The surreal and memorable imagery of the video itself also highlights a willingness to embrace the unconventional, creating a distinct visual identity that resonated with the song's energetic, slightly unhinged quality.
Yeah, it showed a band comfortable with artifice and humor, maybe contrasting with the earnestness of some of their other work. And the accolades for Infinite Arms just continued to pour in, solidifying its place in their discography and in the music scene that year. The album received a Grammy Award nomination in 2011 for Best Alternative Album.
The big one.
A truly significant career milestone that placed them firmly on the mainstream radar, beyond just the indie world.
That Grammy nod is huge validation, isn't it? Placing them firmly within the alternative music landscape's elite. A real signal they were a force to be reckoned with.
Absolutely. It also found its way onto several prestigious Best Albums of 2010 lists. Q Magazine had it at hashtag 21, NPR listeners voted at hashtag 15, Filter Magazine put it at hashtag 10, and Pace Magazine ranked it hashtag 42.
Consistent praise across the board.
Yeah. Not to mention the song Laredo was placed at number 28 in Rolling Stone Magazine's top 50 songs of 2010.
Laredo is a great track.
It is. Even Dilly itself as a single was a minor hit on the Belgian singles chart in Flanders.
This period truly represents their peak in terms of industry recognition and critical acclaim. The consistent presence on year-end lists across diverse publications further emphasizes the album's widespread appeal and impact. It shows that Infinite Arms wasn't just a commercial success, but also resonated deeply with critics and listeners alike. It proved the band's artistic merit and established a benchmark for their sound and ambition that would inevitably shape their subsequent work.
And they kept that momentum going. They continued their extensive touring well into 2011 and 2012, capitalizing on the success of Infinite Arms. This included a European tour in early 2011 that notably featured a major show opening for Foo Fighters at Wembley Arena.
Wembley Arena with the Foo Fighters, that's a massive stage to share.
Huge. They had a brief U.S. tour after that, then more European festival appearances. They were even scheduled to support Kings of Leon on their U.S. and Australian tours.
Another huge tour pairing.
Yeah, although the U.S. leg was unfortunately canceled after only three shows. Mm-hmm. Kings of Leon cited exhaustion.
The perils of stadium touring. That happens.
Yeah. But Band of Horses kept pushing forward. They undertook their first ever South American tour in 2012, further expanding their global footprint.
This relentless touring schedule highlights the momentum they had built and their unwavering commitment to reaching fans worldwide. The Kings of Leon cancellation is an interesting anecdote, though. It illustrates the unpredictable nature of touring at that level and the physical demands it places on artists. But despite setbacks like that, the band's ambitious push into new territories like South America shows their enduring ambition and desire to continually expand their audience. It reinforced their global appeal and proved their resilience in the face of logistical challenges.
Yeah, it showed that Band of Horses was determined to take their music wherever it was wanted. Now, beyond Band of Horses itself, Ben Bridwell was also quite active with collaborative ventures during this period. He wasn't just focused inward. He contributed a George Harrison cover, Your Love is Forever, to a Starbucks Entertainment compilation album called Sweetheart in 2010.
Starbucks compilations, right.
Yeah.
Interesting platform.
He also duetted with Courtney J on a cover of the Jesus and Mary Chains, Sometimes Always, for her 2010 album.
These collaborations really showcase Bridwell's versatility as a vocalist and his willingness to step outside the Band of Horses framework. It demonstrates that his unique voice, with its distinctive blend of fragility and power, was in demand across different projects and genres.
Yeah, establishing him as a respected figure in the broader music community, not just within his own band.
Exactly. These smaller projects allowed him to explore different artistic avenues and keep his creative juices flowing, you know?
And he also made guest vocal appearances on some pretty high-profile tracks, didn't he? He was on Starting Over from Macklemore and Ryan Lewis's huge album, The Heist.
The Heist. Wow, that was everywhere.
Yeah. And he was also on two tracks, Opposite and Accident Without Emergency, from the Biffy Clyro album, Opposites.
Biffy Clyro, big UK rock band. Very different vibe from Macklemore. Absolutely. His contributions to those tracks really highlight his diverse appeal and the distinctiveness of his vocal timbre. Working with Macklemore and Ryan Lewis put him in a very different sonic landscape, reaching a more pop-oriented hip-hop audience and showcasing his ability to adapt his emotive style.
Right. Unexpected, but it worked.
Meanwhile, the Biffy Clyro collaboration cemented his credibility within the alternative rock scene, demonstrating his ability to lend his unique sound to more aggressive or experimental rock contexts. It further solidifies his reputation as a versatile and sought-after vocal talent, capable of elevating a wide variety of musical contexts with his signature delivery. 4. Navigating Change, Mirage Rock, and Acoustic Explorations, 2012-2013.
Okay, moving into 2012, things shift again. Ben Bridwell announced in April that their fourth studio album, titled Mirage Rock, was scheduled for a late 2012 release. And here's a big change. It would be produced by Glyn Johns.
The Glyn Johns. Wow, that's a legendary name. Led Zeppelin, The Rolling Stones, The Eagles, The Who.
Exactly. This was a notable change in producer after working so consistently with Phil Ake. What does that signify when a band makes such a significant shift, especially to someone with John's pedigree?
Well, a shift in producer, especially to someone like Glyn Johns, often signals a conscious desire for a new sonic direction or maybe just a fresh perspective. After self-producing Infinite Arms, with Eek's help, and working extensively with Phil Ake on the previous records, bringing in Johns suggested they were looking to evolve their sound.
Maybe aiming for something different.
Perhaps. Maybe even a more classic rock organic feel, given John's background with those iconic bands from the 60s and 70s. It's usually a deliberate artistic choice to explore new territory to prevent stagnation and to challenge themselves creatively by stepping out of their comfort zone.
They gave fans an early preview in June 2012 with a video for a new song, Dumpster World, which they shared via Facebook and YouTube. Then they announced the September album release. The album titled Mirage Rock was confirmed on July 10th, along with the track listing and artwork. The debut single, Knock Knock, was released on July 9, 2012, and the album itself followed on September 18.
How did it do? Did it match Infinite Arms?
Commercially, maybe not quite the same peak, but both Knock Knock and the subsequent single, Slow Cruel Hands of Time, were minor hits in Belgium.
Ah, Belgium again. They have a loyal following there.
Seems so. This period shows them embracing modern digital promotional tactics, using video previews and social media to build anticipation.
Which was becoming pretty standard practice by then.
Right. And while the singles were maybe minor hits, their consistent charting in European markets like Belgium demonstrates an enduring and loyal international fan base that continued to eagerly support their new material.
Yeah, showing that their appeal definitely stretched beyond just the U.S. and U.K. Mirage Rock itself, how would you describe the sound? Did it reflect that Glyn Johns influence?
I'd say it leaned into a more polished, maybe roots rock sound. A bit cleaner, perhaps. A clear departure from the raw indie rock of their debut, reflecting Johns' production and the band's evolving musical maturity. The music video for Knock Knock, released in late August 2012 and directed by Jared Eberhardt, had a really creative concept. It simulated old-fashioned nature documentaries featuring the band members being captured like animals to be studied.
Huh. That's pretty unique and quite a humorous take on the band's presence, isn't it? Like, they're this strange species. It's a wonderfully inventive visual concept that really sets it apart from typical performance-based music videos. The idea of the band members being captured and studied adds a layer of surreal humor and maybe even introspection. Fitting for a band often praised for its evocative lyrics and sometimes introspective themes, it's a memorable visual that shows their willingness to be playful and artistic in their video work, injecting personality beyond just, you know, looking cool playing their instruments.
And Bridwell himself offered an insightful comment on the filming location. He tied it back to their early work, saying, "It seems fitting that we'd finally get to shoot a video around Salt Lake City, as we've got a song that pays tribute to the area called The Great Salt Lake from our first album, Better Late Than Never."
Ah, nice connection. That subtly links back to their origins, showing a continuity of themes and inspirations across their discography, and a nice nod to their early fans who'd remember that track.
Then in 2014, we saw Band of Horses explore yet another side of their sound with Acoustic at the Ryman.
Ah, the live acoustic album, a classic move.
Yep. This 10-track live album was recorded over two nights in April 2013 at the historic Ryman Auditorium in Nashville.
The mother church of country music. Recording there is a statement in itself.
Totally. It featured, as you'd expect, stripped-down versions of some of their best-known songs.
Recording at the Ryman aligns perfectly with the more folk and southern rock elements of their sound, doesn't it? It's like giving a nod to the American musical tradition. And offering stripped-down versions of their songs allowed listeners to experience their catalog in a new, much more intimate way.
Yeah, it really highlighted the raw strength of the songwriting and Bridwell's distinctive vocals without all the full band arrangements.
It demonstrated a significant versatility and confidence in their material, proving that their songs could stand on their own merit in a stripped-back setting.
They also supported it with a 13-date run of acoustic performances across the U.S., which actually concluded back at the Ryman itself.
Nice. Bringing it home.
Yeah, it further solidified their connection with audiences in a more intimate storytelling context. It was a moment for fans to truly connect with the essence of the songs, I think. Ben Bridwell's collaborative projects continued during this time as well, constantly expanding his artistic reach beyond the main band. He teamed up with Sam Beam of Iron and Wine.
Oh, another great pairing.
Yeah. To release a covers album called Sing Into My Mouth on July 17th, 2015.
That was a highly anticipated and incredibly well-received collaboration. It brought together two really distinct but somehow complementary voices in the indie folk scene. Both artists are known for their introspective, emotive songwriting and unique vocal styles, so their combined effort on a covers album allowed them to pay homage to their influences while creating something entirely new and beautiful.
Yeah, it was a lovely record.
It highlights Bridwell's strong network and mutual respect with other artists, showcasing his ability to blend his style with others while exploring new interpretations of classic songs. Really shows his artistic curiosity and generosity.
And he also contributed two tracks, Unlikely Force and Tara, to the supergroup project BNQT's first album, Volume 1, which came out on April 28, 2017.
BNQT, right. That had members of Midlake, Franz Ferdinand, Granddaddy, quite the lineup.
Yeah, he clearly enjoys these diverse musical ventures outside of Band of Horses.
Indeed. These side projects are crucial, I think. They not only demonstrate his wide-ranging musical interests and his ability to contribute meaningfully to different creative visions, but they also reinforce his reputation as a versatile and sought-after musician within the broader indie and alternative communities.
Keeps things fresh for him, probably.
Exactly. It's a way for him to explore different creative avenues and expand his artistic footprint beyond the primary vehicle of Band of Horses, keeping his own musical palette fresh. V, recent years, departures, returns, and things are great. Do not 15 present.
Okay, now we come to their fifth studio album, Why Are You Okay, which was released in 2016. This album was produced by Jason Little and the band Granddaddy.
Another interesting producer choice. Little has such a distinctive sound.
Yeah. And it was released through Rick Rubin's American Recordings and Interscope Records.
Wow, Rick Rubin's label and Interscope. Those are some highly influential names and major labels to be associated with. Signals a significant investment in the band's future, doesn't it? Absolutely.
Sure.
Working with Jason Lytle, known for his atmospheric and often melancholic indie rock sound with Granddaddy, and releasing through Rick Rubin's American Recordings, a label synonymous with iconic artists across genres, signifies their continued appeal to highly influential figures in the music industry. It suggests a desire to continue evolving their sound, perhaps drawing on Little's distinctive production style to infuse new textures and sonic landscapes.
Yeah, maybe a bit more atmospheric.
Possibly. It speaks to the band's sustained relevance and their ability to attract top-tier talent and distribution, reaffirming their place in the contemporary rock scene. The album itself, Why Are You Okay, was often characterized by a more expansive, dreamy sound. Richer in layers and introspection, perhaps subtly departing from the more direct rock of Mirage Rock.
But 2017 brought some significant internal friction bubbling up to the surface, and very publicly. Tyler Ramsey and Bill Reynolds, who had been key parts of that most stable lineup for nearly a decade.
The Infinite Arms era lineup, basically.
Right. They announced their departures. Tyler Ramsey made his announcement on his personal Instagram account on May 1st, 2017, and Bill Reynolds followed suit the very next day on his Facebook page. These were very public announcements from longstanding members.
These public announcements were a huge turning point, especially considering how stable that lineup had been since the Cease to Begin era. It really felt like the end of an era for what many fans considered the definitive Band of Horses sound.
Yeah, it left fans quite surprised, I remember.
However, what's crucially fascinating here, and truly sheds light on Bridwell's assertive leadership and the internal dynamics, is his later counter-narrative. Years later, in 2022, he publicly disputed Ramsey's and Reynolds' claims that they quit.
Oh, what did he say?
He stated instead that they had instead both been fired from the group.
Fired? Wow, that's different.
It's a starkly contrasting perspective on a major moment in the band's history, isn't it? It reveals internal friction that was far more complex than just a simple, amicable departure. It highlights Bridwell's decisive control and maybe the intensity of creative relationships within the band. It's a powerful revelation about the unseen pressures and disagreements that can occur even in successful groups.
That's a powerful revelation and really changes the narrative of those departures, doesn't it? It frames Bridwell as a leader making tough calls, maybe, for the band's direction. So with Ramsey and Reynolds gone, whether they quit or were fired, how did the band continue? They must have had tour dates limiting.
They did. When touring resumed on May 18th, 2017, just weeks later, Band of Horses immediately brought in replacements to keep the momentum going. Richard Fitzpatrick joined on guitar. And notably, bassist Matt Gentling returned to the fold.
Matt Gentling. Hang on, wasn't he the guy from Arches of Loaf who toured with them way back before Cease to Begin?
The very same. This illustrates a pattern, doesn't it? Familiar faces returning to the band, perhaps reflecting Bridwell's trust in a known network of musicians, or maybe the unique demands of working with his vision and within the band's evolving sound.
Interesting. Did Fitzpatrick stick around?
Nope. Fitzpatrick was subsequently replaced by guitarist Ian McDougall.
So more changes.
It shows the continued, almost cyclical nature of lineup changes around Bridwell. It's a testament to his singular vision driving the project forward through all permutations, really.
Okay, fast forward to 2022 and we get their sixth studio album, Things Are Great. This was their first album with Matt Gentling back on bass and Ian McDougall on guitar. And interestingly, it was described as a return to their earlier work and the kind of raw ethos that lies at the heart of Band of Horses.
Ah, the back to basics album description?
Pretty much. What does that mean in practical terms for the sound, do you think? And how did it resonate with fans after the more expansive Why Are You Okay?
That description is very telling. It suggests a conscious effort to revisit their foundational sound, the more direct, earnest, and maybe less embellished approach of their first couple of albums, like Everything All the Time and Cease to Begin. It felt like a deliberate move to tap back into that original energy that made them so appealing initially, especially after the more lush and dreamier production of Why Are You Okay?
So maybe more guitar-driven again.
Exactly. For fans, it meant a return to powerful guitar-driven anthems and Bridwell's signature emotive vocals front and center, maybe with less of the sonic ornamentation.
The album was released on March 4th, 2022. However, you guessed it.
Another change.
Just prior to its release, the lineup saw yet another change. Ian McDougall, who played guitar on the album, exited the band. And in late January 2022, just before the album dropped, Brett Nash was named as his replacement on lead guitar.
Wow. That really reinforces the band's ongoing evolution in its composition, literally up to the very moment of releasing new material.
It showcases Bridwell's unwavering commitment to the band's sound, or at least his vision for it, even if it meant constant personnel shifts right up to the wire. And the changes didn't stop there, bringing us right up to very recent developments, basically current day. Keyboardist and guitarist Ryan Monroe.
A really longtime member, integral to their sound since the early days.
Exactly. He's been notably absent from the band's shows, starting with a short U.S. tour in March 2025, and continuing into their ongoing summer U.S. tour right now.
That is a significant recent development. Monroe's keyboards and guitar work were so integral to many of their hits, especially from Cease to Begin through Infinite Arms and beyond. He was a huge part of that stable lineup.
Yeah. and his absence from recent group promotional photos has also raised questions among fans about his future with the band.
Though no official announcement has been made as of yet. Right?
Not as far as we know. It indicates that even the most stable foundational elements of Band of Horses can be subject to change, underscoring the dynamic nature of this project.
Yet, despite these ongoing personnel shifts, the band keeps going.
Incredibly, yes. The band continues its creative output. They just released a new single on July 30, 2025.
Wow. That demonstrates a remarkable resilience, doesn't it? An unwavering commitment to making new music, regardless of who is standing beside Ben Bridwell on stage or in the promo photos.
The band truly is a constant state of becoming, it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Six Ben Bridwell. The constant force. And that really brings us full circle. Back to the core of this deep dive, doesn't it? The unwavering constant through all these changes, all these albums, all these tours, all these shifting members. Ben Bridwell.
He's the eye of the storm.
He really is. He is the band's founder and the sole continuous member since 2004. His presence truly is the consistent anchor through all of Band of Horses evolutions and lineup changes.
He is, without a doubt, the gravitational center. Bridwell isn't just the singer. He's a multi-talented visionary whose fingerprints are on every single aspect of the band's identity. His comprehensive roles within the band include lead vocals, guitar, pedal steel, keyboards.
He plays pedal steel, too.
Apparently so. And he's also the primary singer-songwriter, a record producer, and a multi-instrumentalist. This highlights his central, indispensable contribution to the band's distinctive sound and identity. He is the sound of Band of Horses.
That voice is unmistakable.
Exactly. That unwavering voice and lyrical core gives the band its consistent character, even as the instrumental backdrop changes around him. It's a testament to his singular vision that the band retains its essence regardless of personnel.
And we can't forget the journey of Brown Records, his early entrepreneurial venture that we touched upon. We talked about his initial struggles, how it became busier than I ever imagined, and how he felt he cracked under the pressure of people's livelihood.
Right. The first attempt didn't end well.
But it made a comeback for infinite arms, didn't it? And with what seemed like a renewed purpose.
It did. And this is a truly important arc in his personal and professional story, I think. The label's relaunch for Infinite Arms reveals Bridwell's renewed philosophical approach. One perhaps tempered by past struggles, but driven by a deeper conviction. He explained it by saying, "Now I've just heard that call again. A lot of artists are unheard that I think I can try to help with."
So still wanting to help other artists.
Exactly. It demonstrates a consistent, maybe even altruistic, motivation for supporting other artists, even while successfully leading his own major band. It wasn't just a business venture for him anymore. It felt like a deeper calling. It showed a sustained passion for fostering talent beyond his own. This second iteration of Brown Records seems to represent a more mature, grounded approach to his entrepreneurial spirit. He understands the weight of responsibility now, but he's still driven by the desire to lift up other voices.
And on a more personal note, which often ties directly into creative output, Bridwell is also a family man. He married Elizabeth Ray McCann on April 4, 2009. And they have four daughters, Annabelle, Ivy, Birdie, and Georgia.
Four daughters. Wow. Sharing details of his personal life, particularly his family, adds a crucial humanizing dimension to the artist and helps us understand his motivations better. It connects directly back to his earlier decision to relocate the band to South Carolina, remember? That desire for personal grounding and to be around his family amidst the incessant demands of touring.
Right, wanting that anchor.
Precisely. This balance between leading a successful, often volatile band and maintaining a stable family life undoubtedly impacts his artistic output. Perhaps infusing his lyrics with themes of home, love, and the passage of time. It provides a strong foundation for his enduring vision and resilience, showing that the core of Ben Bridwell is as unwavering in his personal life as it seems to be in his musical career.
His journey truly embodies the band's spirit of adaptation and perseverance in the face of constant change, doesn't it? With his family often serving as his anchor through it all. Outro. And that brings us toward the close of this incredible deep dive into Band of Horses and the remarkable, often turbulent journey of Ben Bridwell. From those raw Seattle beginnings, you know, fueled by pizza and shared dreams.
Ha, the pizza days.
And the breakout success of Everything All the Time. And that iconic, truly ubiquitous track, The Funeral. Through the critical acclaim and that huge Grammy nomination for Infinite Arms and their continuous evolution with albums like Mirage Rock, Why Are You Okay? And most recently, Things Are Great.
What stands out through it all, unmistakably, is Ben Bridwell as the unwavering constant. He's the singular creative force navigating constant lineup changes, artistic shifts, and personal growth to keep the band's distinctive sound alive and evolving. It's a true testament to his singular vision, his undeniable talent, his entrepreneurial spirit, and just his sheer perseverance that Band of Horses has not only endured but remained incredibly relevant for over two decades now.
It's really quite something.
Consistently delivering music that resonates deeply with audiences worldwide, his ability to adapt, to lead, and to continuously find the right collaborators, even if they change frequently to bring his vision to life, is truly remarkable.
So as you reflect on Band of Horses' two decades, marked by this constant core and these ever-shifting collaborators, maybe consider this. How much does a foundational, unwavering artistic vision like Ben Bridwell's really drive a band's identity and longevity? And how much is that identity shaped, perhaps subtly or maybe significantly, by the unique contributions of all those musicians who join and depart along the way?
It's a great question. What does this tell us about the very nature of creative projects, especially collaborative ones, and the necessity of adaptation in the face of constant change? Something to think about.